This episode of Navarra Live is brought to you by listeners like you. Thank you. Hello and welcome to Navarra Live. I'm your host, Ash Sarkar, and with me tonight is Joris Lachen. Joris, how are you doing?
I am very well. Very excited to be with you this evening.
You know what? It's always nice to hear that rather than just the normal shit I get from co-hosts, which is, oh, it's you again. Anyway, coming up later tonight, one of Britain's biggest water companies is facing potential nationalisation. We look at the issue of childcare costs and what Britain's two main parties are offering on the issue. And what is Hamas's military strategy? We'll be discussing that shortly, so stay tuned. And before we get going, some breaking news from just before we went live. The International Court of Justice has just issued a new provisional order to Israel. The court has ordered the country to increase humanitarian aid to Gaza within 30 days. The court recognises that famine is now setting in the enclave. It says Israel must facilitate, quote, the unhindered provision at scale of urgently needed basic services and humanitarian assistance, including food, water, electricity, fuel, shelter, clothing, hygiene, and sanitation requirements. It also orders Israel to open more land crossings to allow the flow of aid in, and it warns the country to ensure the military does not commit acts violating the Genocide Convention. Let's go to our first story. The whole of Gaza is now at risk of starvation, while in the north of the Strip, famine is imminent. At least 23 children have died of malnutrition in northern Gaza in recent weeks, with a third of children under two now suffering malnutrition. The deteriorating conditions of the Palestinians has led to multiple humanitarian agencies accusing Israel of using hunger as a weapon of war. But now, UN human rights head Volker Türk has gone further, saying this in an interview with the BBC.
When it comes to humanitarian assistance, let's be clear. Israel is an occupying power and has an obligation to provide humanitarian assistance. And if that humanitarian assistance does not come in the scale, speed, and predictability that is required, yes, very serious questions are raised.
So let's get it very clear. Israel's to blame.
Israel is to blame in a significant way, yes.
You're aware, of course, that Israel says they're not to blame at all, that they give as much aid as is possible, that if anyone's to blame, it's the UN, and it's particularly Hamas.
It is absolutely clear what happened on the 7th and the 8th of October by Hamas and some of the other armed groups is unconscionable. These are flagrant violations of international humanitarian law and international human rights. At the same time, the brutality of the attack by Israel and the method of warfare, it begs the question of the proportionality of the response.
You're saying questions. You say there's no doubt about Hamas. Are there any doubts about Israel?
You always have to prove the intent. But as I said, collective punishment, the collective punishment that was declared with the siege is indeed amounts to a war crime, and it needs to be dealt as such.
The siege and the collective punishment it entails amounts to a war crime. That's the verdict of the UN's highest authority on human rights. Israel's economy minister, Nir Barkat, responded to that claim.
Total nonsense. Total irresponsible thing to say. Israel is accepting all the aid that the US and the world is giving to Gazan innocent people, which a lot of it goes to extend the war.
How many innocent people are in Gaza, in your opinion?
That's not, I'm going to quote any number. I'm basically saying that over 70% of Gazans support October 7 massacre.
So they're not innocent?
People that are supporting Hamas, they have a different thought. They're an enemy. I thank our friends around the world for supporting our strategic goal. And I'm telling you.
But they don't like the way you're doing it, do they?
That's tough. We're going to finish the war. We'll do everything we can to kill the Hamas terrorists and to minimize collateral damage as much as we can.
Maybe it's just me, but putting air quotes around innocent people seriously undermines your claim to be supporting humanitarian interventions. But it's increasingly clear that collective punishment is unlikely to be the IDF's only war crime in Gaza. Al Jazeera has obtained footage appearing to show Israeli soldiers killing two unarmed Palestinian men. And a warning, some may find the video we're about to show you distressing. Two Palestinian men are filmed trying to return to their homes in northern Gaza when they encounter a group of Israeli soldiers stationed in the ruins of a house. In the foreground of the video, one of the men approaches, waving a white cloth. The other man turns around, away from the soldiers. He also raises a white cloth before hurrying back in the direction he came from. At this point, the first man is then obscured by a building in the shot, but the second man is followed along the beach by an IDF armed vehicle. Again, he waves a white cloth at the soldiers. Moments later, the soldiers open fire and he falls to the ground. That has all the hallmarks of the military execution of an unarmed civilian. And yet the footage gets worse. An Israeli bulldozer arrives on the scene shortly after the man has been killed. At this stage, the body of the first man also appears to be lying on the ground. The bulldozer then shovels the first body into a shallow pit in the sand and refuse. It then goes back for the second body, burying it too in what appears to be an attempt to conceal the executions. The killing of two unarmed men is an obvious atrocity, but treating their bodies with such indignity, just shoveling them into the dirt, displays another level of depravity. There have been other reports of executions by the IDF. The Israeli army has executed 13 children in and around Al-Shifa Hospital, according to human rights organisation Euromed Monitor. The IDF has been operating west of Gaza City around Al-Shifa Hospital for the last 9 days. It began with intense bombing of the neighborhood surrounding the medical complex, followed by a siege of the hospital after 1,000 IDF troops encircled it. That's when the killing reportedly began. Euromed say their field monitors have received identical testimonies about the killings and executions of Palestinian children between the ages of 4 and 16. One such testimony was given by Islam Ali Salua, who lived close to the Al-Shifa hospital. The father of two boys, 9-year-old Ali and 6-year-old Saeed, he says his family was ordered to leave their home last Sunday by Israeli soldiers or face being bombed. Euromed Monitor reports this about what happened next. As a result, the residents were forced to leave the area with a number of their neighbours and cross a corpse-strewn road that the Israeli army had designated for travel. Saluha said that they were only able to walk for tens of metres before they were suddenly exposed to intense gunfire, which targeted the two children, Ali and Saeed in particular. The children then fell in front of them, their bodies covered in blood. As they attempted to pull the two kids off the ground, he said, the Israeli forces opened fire on them again, forcing them to leave Ali and Saeed on the ground and to continue walking. Salua emphasized that his son Ali was killed in a field execution crime after he had been deprived of food for days because of the Israeli siege. He also pointed out that the area around Al-Shifa Medical Complex had become a hotspot for field executions and murders, with the bodies of the victims discovered in the streets serving as evidence. It's in that context that the IDF today announced this. 24-hour operational update, Shifa. Our troops evacuated patients and medical teams to alternative medical facilities set up by the IDF to enable the continuation of proper medical treatment. Terrorists fired at troops from within and outside Shifa's ER building. Approximately 200 terrorists have been eliminated since the beginning of the operation. Besides killing 200 people at a medical complex, the IDF has also released some of the medical personnel it took prisoner. The Palestinian Red Crescent Society has said this. The Israeli occupation forces have recently released seven detainees from the Palestine Red Crescent teams who were arrested during the raid on Al Amal Hospital on the 9th of the 2nd, 2024, after spending 47 days in occupation prisons. Among them is the Director of Ambulance and Emergency Services in Gaza, Mohammed Abu Musabeh. Meanwhile, the occupation continues to detain eight members of the PRCS, whose fate remains unknown at the moment. Hashtag not a target, hashtag IHL. The targeting of medical personnel is also a violation of international humanitarian law. And look, at some point, the detention, abuse, and killing of healthcare professionals, journalists, and other civil society leaders looks less like an accident and more like a policy. Let's move on to our next story. One thing that you don't hear so much about in Western media is any analysis of what militant groups like Hamas are thinking strategically. And there's a reason for this. It comes from the war on terror. Rather than thinking about designated terrorist groups as being political and military organizations, which have strategic objectives and an internal logic for their actions, we're encouraged to think of them as being irrationally evil, animalistic, and barbarous. And the problem with that is that you don't end up with much of an idea of what's going on or what's going to happen next. So what does Hamas have to say about their own military and political aims? Al Jazeera reported these quotes of Khalil al-Yahya, the deputy chief of Hamas political bureau, from an interview conducted by Press TV. "We've revealed to the whole world the true face of the Israeli occupation," the Hamas official said. "While the Palestinian cause is the cause of all Muslims, the amount of support shown by other Arab countries has not been sufficient," he added. Yet, he hoped that the sum of this support will lead to victory. Al-Yahya also told Press TV that America will pay a dear price in terms of its interests around the world for its support to Israel. What this means is that Hamas doesn't see the huge loss of life in Gaza since October 7th or the destruction of its governmental infrastructure as a blow to its objectives. Instead, their goal is to delegitimize Israel's international standing by provoking them into an enormous, bloody, and genocidal act of retribution. What's more, Israel's actions in Gaza have threatened the normalization process with other Arab states like Saudi Arabia. And as American military targets have come under attack by Iranian-backed militias in Jordan, Syria, and Iraq, it's clear that events since October the 7th have kept the US entangled in the Middle East exactly at the time they'd rather be focusing on Russia and Eastern Europe. So, by these narrow metrics at least, Hamas have succeeded in achieving some of its strategic objectives. Back in November, Khalil al-Yahya told the New York Times this: "We succeeded in putting the Palestinian issue back on the table, and now no one in the region is experiencing calm." Now, there are good reasons to be skeptical of this. Obviously, it's in Hamas's interests to claim that everything is going according to plan, even if the losses incurred in Gaza are much higher than their leadership may have anticipated back in October. Israel has the military advantages of equipment, technology, money, and mobilization in Gaza. But fierce battles around the site of Al-Shifa Hospital in Gaza City indicate that Hamas fighters have the ability to capitalize on the constraints that urban warfare has on conventional armies. I want to show you a heat map from the Critical Threats Project and the Institute for the Study of War. It shows attacks by Palestinian militants on Israeli forces in northern Gaza since mid-February of this year. You can see there are high concentrations of attacks in and around Gaza City, particularly in and around Al-Shifa Hospital. Now, all of this is taking place in territory that's coloured blue on the map, indicating areas where Israeli clearing operations had already taken place. The purple striped areas show, quote, areas reportedly infiltrated by Palestinian militias. The human cost of Israeli operations in North Gaza have been nothing short of devastating. According to a UN report, 70% of the population are already suffering with catastrophic levels of hunger. And reports have emerged from Al-Shifa Hospital alleging execution-style killings and other abuses by Israeli forces. But what the Critical Threats Project are implying is that the civilian suffering in northern Gaza hasn't deterred militant activity. They write this. Most of the Palestinian militia attacks on March 27th targeted Israeli forces in and around Al-Shifa Hospital. Palestinian militias have conducted nearly 70 attacks targeting Israeli forces in and around the hospital since Israeli forces returned to the area on March 18th. This high rate of attack indicates that Palestinian militias retain a significant degree of combat effectiveness in the area, despite continued Israeli clearing efforts around Gaza City. The report continues. A Palestinian journalist reported on March 27th that Israeli forces advanced into parts of Zeitoun neighborhood in southwestern Gaza City. The IDF concluded a two-week-long re-clearing of Zeitoun on March the 3rd. The return of Israeli forces to the neighborhood suggests that Palestinian militias continue to operate there, similar to how these militias still have a presence in other portions of the northern Gaza Strip. To put it bluntly, Hamas and other militant groups are popping up in areas which the IDF had supposedly established control over. After claiming to have destroyed Hamas infrastructure and established its presence in Gaza City, the IDF keep finding themselves pulled back into firefights. Despite having lobbied hard for a ground invasion and demanded the wholesale destruction of Hamas as a military objective, it looks like the Israeli army have been caught short in their planning. This is from an FT report about the battle for Al-Shifa Hospital. The fact that Israel had to go back to this place is a reflection of the fact that we have no strategy. That's from Michael Milstein, former Israeli intelligence officer. What I'd add is that what we're seeing in northern Gaza isn't just an indictment of Israel's post-war planning. It's indicative of some of the disadvantages of being a technologically superior conventional army. Israeli forces have been leading with heavy aerial bombardment before sending ground troops into urban areas. Their rationale is that this is safer for their troops, even if it means killing thousands of Palestinian civilians in the process. But as anyone who's watched the Battle of Stalingrad could tell you, there are downsides to fighting in rubble. It's a lot harder for ground troops to navigate bombed-out streets and buildings. Part of the reason is likely to be that Israel's army is made up of reservists and conscripts as well as regular troops, meaning they're not sending in an elite team of special forces. These are guys who aren't all well-trained or super experienced. But if you're fighting a guerrilla war like Hamas and the PIJ are, there are advantages to fighting an enemy that's bogged down by destroyed roads and debris. And Hamas fighters are highly trained, they're disciplined, and a lot of them are quite experienced. They might not have the advantages of high-tech weaponry and surveillance, but unlike the IDF, they're fighting on home turf. Joris, Netanyahu has vowed to keep fighting in Gaza until Hamas is destroyed. Does the fact that they keep on popping up in areas supposedly cleared by the IDF mean that, ironically, his political survival is connected to their military survival?
Is it even this ironic? I mean, this wouldn't be the first time that Netanyahu's interests and Hamas's interests align, or Likud's interests and Hamas's interests align. Netanyahu knows that the day the war ends is also the day his whole career ends, with all of the trouble that he already had before. And plus this situation, the war, the fact that it's still going now is already a failure from Netanyahu's perspective. So in this instance, it's in his interest to make it last as long as possible. But from a military perspective, the IDF's interests are the opposite. Because here, Hamas's goal initially was to provoke and shock Israel, which they did on the 7th of October. But after that, no one, including Hamas, doubted that the IDF would have military superiority. So their strategy became surviving, making it surviving until the end of the war. They win by not losing. From Hamas's perspective, they win by not losing. Whereas for the IDF loses by not winning. And on the other hand, the Israeli leadership sort of backed themselves into a corner. Netanyahu backed himself into a corner by amplifying the message that Hamas is an existential threat to Israel, because it leaves them no acceptable outcome than total annihilation, which is pretty much impossible. How would you even prove that? How would you determine whether Hamas is destroyed or not? And this is something that they keep repeating. They want total destruction of Hamas. But do we even know what that would look like? How would we know that Hamas has been destroyed? And how do you destroy a group of people, especially when they are among civilians as well? So here, the goals of the IDF and the goals of Hamas are completely asymmetric. Not losing on war is, for Hamas, is much more attainable as a strategic goal than outright winning it, which was or would have been the IDF's goal, and which they didn't achieve or they haven't achieved yet. So some military analysts claim that Israel has already lost the war simply by not outright winning it, and regardless of the outcome of the conflict.
I mean, one of the things that struck me as I was researching this story and writing it up is that a very simple question doesn't get asked in mainstream media, which is, from Hamas's perspective, is this war going well or going badly? And for me, that just seems like such an obvious question to ask. Why is it that we don't see it posed in English-speaking media?
Because that would entail thinking about what Hamas might be thinking. So that's humanizing them already. And that's something that we have been conditioned to not do, to not consider them as human. As you said, they are being demonized. They are described as animals without any rational thoughts. And that's orchestrated by Israel to present the enemy as non-human, as a monster, as a scary, dangerous monster. So we are being conditioned to not consider that, whether we agree with them or not, and obviously we don't agree with them, but to not consider them as rational thinking. So that's the reason why we never really ask that question, because just the mere exercise of thinking, how is it going for them, that forces you to walk in their shoes, which is something that we're not ready to, or at least the West as a society is not ready to allow us to do.
I mean, Sun Tzu famously said, know yourself and know your enemy, and you need not fear the result of 1,000 battles. And it seems to me that media and politics are united in a message that the enemy is stupid, even when they're not, which can only be bad news. Let's move on a little bit. We've talked about what the Battle of Al-Shifa can tell us about Hamas's military strategy. But one incident that occurred at the hospital also tells us something about how the group wants and needs to be seen on the world stage. In other words, it gives us an insight into their political strategy. In reporting on the war, Israel is generally seen as a credible source by Western media, though that reputation has certainly been dented over the last 6 months. We've seen falsehoods picked up involving burned and beheaded babies, atrocities denied by Israel only to be quietly confirmed later, and the government's continued insistence that aid is getting into Gaza. Despite the denial of that claim by every major humanitarian agency in the world. Hamas, however, is never seen as credible. For example, the death and injury figures of the Hamas-run Gazan Health Ministry were disparaged by both Israel and the President of the United States, only to later be accepted by all parties as reasonably accurate. So, why is it so important to Hamas to put out accurate casualty figures? Well, the simple answer is that it helps them delegitimize Israel in the eyes of the international community. What they want is for the testimony coming out of Gaza to be believed by the wider world. Which is why something fairly unusual occurred at Al-Shifa earlier this week. During the IDF's assault on the medical complex, one Palestinian woman made these claims about the Israeli soldiers. They raped women, kidnapped women, executed women, and pulled dead bodies from under the rubble to unleash their dogs on them. Is there anything more horrifying than hearing women call for help? Al Jazeera published a video of that woman's testimony. But it quickly prompted a Hamas investigation, with Al Jazeera's former managing director, Abu Hilale, saying this shortly afterwards. It was revealed through Hamas investigations that the story of the rape of the woman in Shifa Hospital was fabricated. Of course, the enemy did not hesitate to commit the crime of genocide. The woman who spoke about rape justified her exaggeration and incorrect talk by saying that the goal was to arouse the nation's fervor and brotherhood, as if more than 30,000 martyrs, 90,000 wounded, about a million displaced people, and comprehensive destruction were not enough. Al Jazeera immediately removed their video. But what that speedy investigation shows is how seriously Hamas takes preserving the credibility of Palestinians' testimony as a key plank in their overall strategy. Now, before our next story, I do have a favour to ask. If you want to help us out with the algorithm, follow Navara Live on Spotify. It really does help new people find us, and whenever we're above the rest is politics in the charts, Alistair Campbell gets upset. So please follow us on Spotify and leave us a review. I think you can find the link in the description. Fox is giving me a thumbs up. I must be correct. Let's move on. One of Britain's worst performing private utility companies has had the money taps turned off by its investors. Thames Water is the biggest water company in the UK, and it's now facing nationalisation unless it can plug a £500 million hole in its finances. But it has a plan. It's the same plan every failing private enterprise has turned to when it hits hard times since the dawn of capitalism. They want you to pay for it by raising bills by 40%. Thames Water has been beset by financial problems since it emerged that the company could potentially collapse under the weight of its own enormous debts. It currently owes around £14 billion, that's against a value of only £2 billion, after 62% of its value was wiped away earlier this year. Last July, the company's shareholders had agreed to inject £750 million in cash to offset some of that debt as part of a £3.75 billion investment over the next few years. £500 million of that was due by the end of this month. But shareholders went back on their promise, releasing this statement. After more than a year of negotiations with the regulator, Ofwat has not been prepared to provide the necessary regulatory support for a business plan which ultimately addresses the issues that Thames Water faces. As a result, shareholders are not in a position to provide further funding to Thames Water. Shareholders will work constructively with Thames Water, Ofwat and the government on how to address the consequences of Ofwat's decision. Ofwat is the water regulator, determining how much water companies can charge their customers and what costs it can pass on to them. Thames Water had asked the regulator to weaken the rules around how it does business. In particular, Thames Water wanted to be allowed to raise bills by 40% to avoid having to make capital investments in infrastructure like sewers and pipes, and to be let off for fines they were expecting to receive. Ofwat said no, and has said this about the company's situation. Safeguards are in place to ensure that services to customers are protected regardless of issues faced by shareholders of Thames Water. Today's update from Thames Water means the company must now pursue all options to seek further equity for the business to turn around the performance of the company for its customers. In other words, suck it up. The company's chief executive, Chris Weston, whose pay package is worth up to £2.3 million per year, was upbeat, saying it was, quote, business as usual for Thames Water. To be fair to Weston, he's only been in the job since December. That was after former chief executive Sarah Bentley abruptly left. There's something about sinking ships and rats, I believe. The imminent collapse of the firm has led to speculation that the government may need to nationalise it. That would come at an estimated cost of £5 billion, and Chancellor Jeremy Hunt has said he's monitoring the situation very closely. But a different government minister knew exactly who he wanted to blame. Levelling Up Minister Michael Gove said this to Sky News.
Well, I think the leadership of Thames Water has been a disgrace. I think for years now, we've seen the customers of Thames Water taken advantage of by successive management teams that have been taking out profits and not investing as they should have been. When I was Environment Secretary, I called this out. They haven't changed their ways. I have zero sympathy for the leadership of Thames Water. In my own constituency, I've seen how they've behaved in a high-handed and arrogant way towards the consumers who pay their bills. So the answer is not to hit the consumers. The answer is for the management team to look to their own approach and ask themselves why they're in this difficult situation. And of course, the answer is because of serial mismanagement for which they must carry the can.
Now, that's a very interesting statement from Gove, who was, of course, Environment Secretary between 2017 and 2019. Water was a part of his brief, as was regulating the financial excesses of the water companies. In 2018, he threatened water companies with a major crackdown after CEO pay and shareholder dividends spun out of control. That was in the context of then Labour leader Jeremy Corbyn pledging to nationalise utilities in 2017, a pledge that helped him reduce Theresa May's majority. But as with many things Tory, nothing ever came of Gove's promised reforms. And it looks like nothing much will change if Starmer's Labour wins the next election. Shadow Treasury Minister Pat McFadden was asked about nationalisation on The World at One.
A lot of people say this is a natural monopoly that should be renationalised. Does Labour lean that way when it comes specifically to water?
No, I mean, if we were to promise to nationalise the whole thing, it would be a lot of resources in the short term, and it wouldn't deal with the issue which is at the top of voters' minds right now, which is this issue of sewage spills into rivers and the sea. And the way to do that is much stronger regulation. The way to do that is to deny bonuses and indeed have fines for companies that don't do the right thing on this, and to change the incentives so that the companies have got to take this much more seriously. Thames Water and the position it's got itself into is an indictment of what's been going on in recent years. But the answer to it, from our point of view, is tougher regulation and putting the right incentives in there that make sure we have the clean water supply that the public have the right to expect.
That answer is pretty irritating. And it's even more irritating if you look at who the shareholders of Thames Water actually are. They include companies linked to sovereign wealth funds of nations such as China and the United Arab Emirates. In other words, Thames Water customers are paying to enrich the investment portfolios of other countries. And it's only an obsessive commitment to ideology by both the Labour and the Tories that's preventing that money from being reinvested in the UK instead. Joris, since water was privatised in 1989, the companies have built up a debt mountain of over £60 billion. Shareholders have received over £72 billion. So why are both major companies in favour of sticking by such a bad deal?
Well, I don't think that it's surprising that the Tories are sticking to it. But now the question of the Labour, I think, as you mentioned, there's an ideology behind it. And I think that we have to face the fact that the Labour is, surprise, not anti-capitalist. So they subscribe to this idea that the market is the best way to deal with industry and with services as well, even though that does not apply to water, because we never have and never will get to choose who puts the water in our taps. So that should not be, that should be something that does not belong to the market. But there's no recognition from the Labour Party and the likely future government of there's no willingness to challenge that, because ideologically they actually align in this instance with the Tory party and the people who are in power. And then there's the other thing is that Labour knows that they are going to be in power very soon, and they do not want to have to deal with that, because if they were to nationalise Thames Water, that would mean having to deal with the debt. So it's much more politically interesting for them to threaten to nationalise, but to not actually do it, because they do not want that burden on them, and they do not want that responsibility. So it's politically quite easy to criticize the failures, but without actually getting it out of the market, because then that would mean that they would have to be accountable to the voters and the taxpayers. Whereas if the debt is still privatized, then it's still the taxpayer who end up paying, and it's still the residents who will end up paying more for the same service, but they don't have the responsibility of it. So they come out of it clean. And so it's much more interesting, and they have therefore no incentive to nationalize.
I mean, it was interesting to hear you use the phrase, you know, they believe that the market will do a better job of providing the service. Because when you think about it, water privatization isn't an example of free market capitalism. Because if you don't like the water coming out of your tap, you can't be like, all right, I'll just switch to another provider. There isn't another provider. So essentially, me and you are just captives, right? We're not customers. We don't have a choice about whether or not we need water. So if you were a true ideological free market capitalist, you'd be like, there's something going wrong here, because there isn't actual competition.
And that's where the ideology prevents them from accepting or realizing that. And they know that if they realize, or if they recognize that, that's the open door to then challenging everything, the entire neoliberal system. And yes, the customer here is held to ransom, because we don't get to choose, and we just have to pay more. If it fails, we pay more. If it succeeds, we pay more, because then it goes into dividends and the shareholders. So we don't have a say. We don't have a say in the service, in the quality of the service, in the choice of the service. And we also don't have a say in what we're being paid. So this is exactly supposedly the opposite of what capitalism and neoliberalism was supposed to bring to us, because that was supposed to give us choice and the power of choice, and we vote with our purse. That is not the case. It was never the case. It was purely ideological. So it was not a belief in the market. It was hatred of the state and the idea of collective power. And we can trace that back to also the dismantling of class consciousness, because the idea of people getting together and having a say, that is the worst enemy of the capitalist and the neoliberal. So isolating them by telling them that they have they can vote with their purse was the idea, but obviously that does not apply here. That does not apply when we don't get a choice, when the customer does not get a choice.
It's just a fucking con, really. It's just a fucking con. Let's move on to our final story. We must be gearing up for an election, because Labour and the Tories are locked in a good old-fashioned round of mudslinging. In the blue corner, we have the government taking advantage of a policy rollout to attack Labour. And in the red corner, we have the opposition complaining that their attack line on the government appears to have blown up in their faces. So, what's going on? Well, in an uncharacteristic fit of generosity, the government announced an expansion of funded childcare for working parents in England. The Mirror explains the changes here. Under current rules, parents of 3 and 4-year-olds can claim 15 hours a week free childcare as standard. Some working parents are entitled to 30 hours a week, so an additional 15 hours depending on their earnings. Working parents of 9-month-olds will be eligible for 15 hours free childcare from September 2024, before this then expands to the full 30 hours a week from September 2025. An expansion of free childcare, that's great news, apart from a couple of small hitches. First of all, the government website through which parents could get their eligibility codes to access free childcare, it was on the blink. According to the charity Pregnant Then Screwed, just 11% of eligible parents were able to get their code using the website. Rishi Sunak has since reassured everyone that the problem has been fixed, but others still lurk in the background. This is from ITV News. When the policy was announced last year, many in the childcare sector warned it would be tough to expand the free provision unless staffing shortages were resolved. Charities are now claiming they haven't been. And on top of that long-standing issue, many nurseries say they still don't know their funding rates, meaning they are currently unable to confirm whether they will be providing care to two-year-olds under the scheme. Some estimates suggest that more than 100,000 extra staff would be required to meet increased demand. Scenting problems with the childcare rollout, Labour have gone on the offensive, promising to conduct a review of the current childcare system. They've also refused to commit to keeping the free childcare expansion. This was Shadow Education Secretary Bridget Phillipson on Newsnight earlier this week.
Well, it's Liz Truss all over again. They've got no plan about how they make it happen. And I think they risk crashing the childcare system just as they crash the economy under Liz Truss. We've heard from providers that they are just going to really struggle to make this happen. And what we hear from parents right across the country is that when they go and try to access these entitlements, these commitments that the Conservatives have made, the places just aren't there. I'm determined that the approach that Labour will take is different, and that's why I've asked Sir David Bell, who was formerly the Chief Inspector of Ofsted, to lead an early years review for Labour so that when we set out further commitments around this, and I will have more to say going into the general election, we are clear about how we make this happen.
We've got stage one the 1st of April, stage two September this year, that's probably before election, but the final stage, September 25, that's definitely after the election. It sounds like you're saying, back to the drawing board, I can't guarantee that.
The system does require reform overall, because what we saw in the budget was just a tacking on of additional commitments to a system that I don't think is working either for providers or for parents. If Labour wins that election, if we form that next government, if we secure the trust of the British people, there'll be an awful lot of problems that we've got to sort. And this is one of the biggest and most pressing priorities that we face. But it's also an area of real opportunity where if we do things differently, we can make sure that we're setting up children to succeed.
You can see that Labour have gone into full milk monitor mode there. And did you clock that Liz Truss reference? It's all about presenting the Tories as being reckless in their policy ideas, and Labour in turn as the sensible technocrats. But the thing is, expanding free childcare is quite a popular policy. So the government have tried turning the attack around on Labour. Here's what Secretary of State for Work and Pensions Mel Stride had to say on Twitter. Labour have announced they will scrap our plan to give working parents 30 hours of free childcare a week, which starts on Monday, cutting support immediately from tens of thousands of parents who have already signed up. Now, as you can see, that tweet received a community note pointing out that Mel Stride hasn't been entirely faithful to what the Labour position actually is. Labour haven't said they'll scrap it, but they haven't said they'll keep it either. However, Labour's decision to reserve judgment on whether they'll keep free childcare expansion hasn't exactly inspired confidence in prospective voters. This was a headline from iNews. I'll think twice, Labour risking parents' votes if Tory free childcare dropped. Just so you know, that's not a good headline from the perspective of Labour HQ. And here's what one woman had to say again to iNews. Victoria Moy, mother to a two-year-old girl and three-month-old baby, said she would think twice before voting Labour in the general election, even though the party previously appealed to her if free childcare support was dropped. You do tend to vote for whoever's going to improve your personal situation, and this is just hugely disappointing, the 32-year-old freelance PR consultant from Lewes, East Sussex, said. What's the point in working so hard just to have zero support for things like childcare? Joris, this Labour attack on the Conservatives' childcare plan has backfired a bit. Are they just using Liz Truss as a code for the government shouldn't try to do stuff?
So Their Liz Truss is what Jeremy Corbyn was, so the sort of scarecrow, being the cause of all of the issues and what could have been worse or what should be to blame. So yes, they're absolutely using that as the worst possible outcome would have been Liz Truss. But that's quite interesting because, of course, they're going back to the same criticism, always the same criticism, and it's more performative, and it's a theatre really that our British politics. The two main parties are perfectly in sync, actually, in criticising each other, regardless of whether what they're criticising them on is something that their electorate would align with or not. It's pure posturing, and the public is getting sick of that, and they're getting more and more clued up to that and to the theatrical nature and the fake nature of that the opposition. One side proposes a policy, the other side rebukes it, even if people would actually align with it. So that creates a sort of the public is exhausted, is tired, and has lost trust in both sides. And what does that mean? That means that is the open door for one who has the appearance of challenging that theatre. So, of course, who takes advantage of this? They are people with populists in the worst sense of the term. They are the Boris Johnsons and the Nigel Farage who present themselves as outside of this system, of this theatre, or who appear to not know the codes. And the mere fact of not knowing the codes, that's already something that becomes appealing to the public when we see such theatre. And here in this instance, the Tory measure is not viable. So Labour in many ways is correct in wanting to challenge it. It's not viable because, yes, it offers more hours, more childcare hours, but it doesn't put in place the human infrastructure that would be required to expand this amount of hours. So what does that mean? It simply means more work for the already overworked childcare workers. So that's not something that is actually viable, but it makes you look very good when you propose such a measure because parents want they want more childcare. So that's perfect. That's a perfectly easy proposal that costs nothing politically, and that it sort of forces the opposition, here the Labour, to criticise it, even if their electorate would actually would like that. And it shows the laziness of the Labour Party because they know they're going to be in power, so they don't have to make any effort. And I think there would not be any problem if they had a vision. If they came to the public and they said, look, we disagree with this Tory measure, but this is our vision. This is what we want to do. But of course, Labour don't have that. So all they can do is propose a review, challenge and say, oh, it's not going to work. So we're going to review it. But the public doesn't like that because all they hear no alternative. There's no better solution. It's just, oh, the little that this government gave you, we are ready to take it away. So that was almost a trap set by the Tories, and the Labour walked right into it.
I mean, I want to talk about demographics for just one second, because it used to be that the fertility rate in the UK was 2.4. So the average number of children people would have would be 2.4. Today it's about 1.65. We have an ageing population, and it seems that no political party wants to address that by either boosting the fertility rate by expanding free childcare significantly, dealing with housing costs, making employment more secure, making benefits more generous, scrapping the two-child cap on benefits. They also don't want to be seen to be pro-immigration, because one way of getting young working-age people into the labour market is letting them move here from other countries. And also, they don't want to say, okay, well, we'll just have an ageing population with low immigration, but a high level of wealth taxation, because that's how you can pay for the infrastructure needed to deal with an aging population and top up pensions, so on and so forth. So, I mean, what has any major party, in your view, addressed demographics in a serious way, or are they just in denial?
they're in denial and they haven't addressed demographics in the same way as they haven't addressed productivity. Productivity in the West has increased considerably. So in theory, we should work less. And in the same way, we have fewer children. So in theory, there should be more available childcare hours for the parents. But neither of those things are happening, because that would necessitate a redistribution of the wealth and a reconsideration of how we organize work. Because when we think about childcare, it's also about work. If you have that so many hours occupied at work, then of course that makes you less able to have a child and to take care of a child. So those two things, labor, productivity, and childcare, are completely, and the entire system that we're in relies on the maintenance of something that not only doesn't work, but that is no longer necessary. We do not need to work as much as we do. The salaries do not need to be as low as they are. All of that is purely artificially maintained. And the issue of fertility is also, we should be opening our borders. We should be welcoming immigration, because economically, this is what makes sense. But again, ideologically, this is not acceptable. And the system that we're on relies on being in denial. Denial of the amount of hours that we need to work, denial of the necessity of having more workforce coming in. So yes, my answer is denial.
Doesn't seem like you're that keen on either major party. There's a general election coming up. Do you think that you could be tempted to giving anyone your vote?
Out of those two ones, no, absolutely not. I am a leftist, but I think that Labour has frayed so far away from the left that I do not recognize myself in the Labour, in what they promise, in what they do. My vote will not go to either of those.
Very coy, but also very definitive at the same time. That has brought us to the end of tonight's show. Thank you, Joris, so much for joining me tonight.
Thank you, Ash.
And thanks to all of you for tuning in. Make sure to come back tomorrow at 6 p.m. You've been watching Novara Media. Good night.
This broadcast is brought to you by Novara Media. Go to novaramedia.com/support.